Everybody hear me? I was kind of glad that you had this very fun, loose beginning, because these poems are, as you might imagine, fairly serious. I write a lot of different kinds of poems, and if you looked at the first three books, you would see that. But I'm going to do something tonight a little different, which is to just read from this book and to try to give you a flavor of the book by reading a number of poems that kind of give you the drift of it. And there are different lengths. One of them is actually eight parts. But I'll probably skip the numbering and all that kind of stuff and just deliver each poem. This is actually a picture of my parents on the cover, and I was saying earlier that they'd probably be embarrassed to have all this attention brought to them, but nonetheless, that's what I was moved to do. So I'm going to start with the first poem in the volume. It's called Done. She walks from the bedroom one morning, drops down in her chair, and quietly, firmly declares, "I'm done." "You're what?" my father asked this woman, who has spent nearly 90 years bustling about houses, basements, yards. She looks at him, a weariness accrued over their marriage's half a century, flooding her worn-out body, eyes, and voice. "I'm done. I'll just stay here." From that time on, my mother sits in the same blue chair day after day after day, no longer cooks or cleans, rises only to make her way to bed or the blue room, as she taught us to call the toilet, a word she regards as vulgar. Puzzling to me as a child, since it wasn't blue, I mean, not a trace. She's wrong. There's so much more to come. Before she's truly done, she'll find herself sitting in a pew at her husband's funeral, in her same blue chair, but moved to a new assisted living room, in a strange chair at a nursing home two towns away, lying not just alone in her own marriage bed, but on ambulance stretchers, nursing home and hospital mattresses. And after she's gone, the mortician's gurney, coffin-soft satin fabric, damp New Jersey clay. But neither one knows that now, as she sits, her gaze less than serene, and says once more, "I'm done." Her husband, stunned at her stillness, stands hoping someone will tell him quickly what in the world she can possibly mean. So my mother seemed, as that poem suggests, to be suddenly failing. But in the end, a few months later, my father actually fell, broke his collarbone. Doesn't sound like much, but when you're 86, it's a big deal. He ended up in the hospital and seemed to be getting better, and then took a turn for the worse, and that was the end. So this next poem is the longest poem, the one in eight parts, and it's called Catastrophe. And at the top, there's a sort of gloss on the word. The tragic denouement or unknotting of a play or story, the catastrophe often spirals outward and causes suffering to those the hero loves or wants to protect. From the Greek katastrophen, to ruin, undo. And in the poem itself, if you were to read it in the book, I take that all those phrases and I spread them out over the eight parts, but I'm just going to skip those and read the actual poem. Catastrophe. The call, when it comes, is not the first or last. It's just the one that changes everything. Before it, other news, foreshadowing, plot complications, aspirated food, talk of a feeding tube, parapetire when he takes a sudden turn for the worse, pneumonia leaving the feeding tube talk far behind. Too late all at once to try such bold device, dramatic intervention. Come now, move fast, get here quick as you can. No time to waste, it could be hours, days. in high gear now. I'm trying to make it back in time for the impending denouement. I booked the grievance fare, a rental car, then packed my badge, remembering to bring the dark gray suit bought months ago, but not yet worn. Time at last to don my costume, assume my role in this catastrophe. I make my way to the check-in desk, explain my situation. The sullen clerk looks up my reservation, then tells me there's a problem. I can't fly because the reservation must be paid in cash. The credit card needs 24 hours to clear. No, I say, they told me on the phone that I'm all set. My father's dying, I say. He looks at me impassively. There's nothing I can do. Then get me someone who can, I guess. A menace in my voice so marked, a dozen heads in earshot turn and look. What seems to be the problem, another clerk asks. Problem? My father's dying and this fool won't let me on the goddamn plane. Give me a minute and I'll help you here. I take one step aside, still staring hard at my antagonist, letting the hate stream from my eyes. And all at once he looks as if he knows he's been a jerk, but keeps his eyes averted from my gaze. When the other has helped me at last, I turn back to him and hiss, asshole. But my catharsis feels incomplete, knowing as I do how much my mother would condemn my using such language, no matter the provocation, rebuke my bad behavior if she heard that word. And when at last, blinking nervously, he raises his head and meekly bears my wrath, as if he were the victim of some crime I perpetrated or might yet perform, I suddenly see what a pitiful figure he is, mere complication, minor character. Boarding the red eye, I discover my seat's on the aisle, yes, but in the last half row with a toilet right across from me and the flight attendants clustered just behind in this slim, cramped tube. Yet somehow this awful spot seems right for the journey I'm taking up in the air all night, hurtling through darkness, never knowing from moment to moment if my father's dead or alive. An hour in, nearly everyone's asleep, but I sit wide awake in the murk, thinking, remembering, wondering, fully alert, yet numb at the same time, dry-eyed, but wishing I could weep. The flight attendants' hushed voices, ghostly movements, a faint glow of tiny lights, the muffled engine roar, and running over and over through my head, hell at 30,000 feet. Or purgatory? Limbo? Before I collect the rental car, I need to meet my sister flying in from elsewhere on her morning flight. She's not at the gate when I land, but as I walk the long corridor, she comes into view, standing on the checkpoint's far side. She shoots me a little wave, looking troubled but calm. When I come up beside her, though, she falls into my arms and begins to weep. The airline rep standing nearby looks faintly alarmed. I shrug, raise my eyebrows as if to say, what's a man to do? Averting her gaze, she leaves us to our grief. Recovered and riding shotgun now in the rental car, my sister insists she wants to go home first, check in with our mother. I want, more than anything, to race to the hospital while there's still time, or it might be, to see our father before he dies. And it's my rental. She's my passenger. But in the end, I decide not to fight her, as well as not to forgive her, ever, if we don't make it to his side in time. In the end, after a brief visit with our mother, we head to the hospital and find our father still breathing, but in no state to talk. Though he seems to know we're there, hear the words we speak, despite not knowing what to say. I want to stay with him from now until the end, whenever that is, but no one knows when that will be. Not exactly, though we're told it won't be much longer now. Hours, maybe, or days, perhaps. but soon. On the way, my sister said she'd been reading up on these things, and it turns out the dying like to pick their moments, waiting sometimes till a loved one gives in at last to that rumbling in the belly and steps out for a quick snack. The idea, I guess, is that your death's your own, your last possession to share or not share as you see fit, to spare or not to spare loved ones and others from the memory of that last moment, of that last lost breath. So dirty stay up, as my mother calls me, and still on California time, I say, okay, I'll take the night shift then, so he won't be alone within the pre-dawn hours he goes, gently or not, into the night. Alone in the dark by the bed, but not alone, not really, my father asleep beside me, if sleep is the word. More like delirium, this sleep from which he won't most likely wake before the end arrives. In the neighboring bed, a young man who almost died in a motorcycle crash, but when the doctor told him how close he'd come to not being here, he laughed it off, confident of his immortality. The young man sleeping, snoring peacefully, but my father's migrating back and forth between agitation and calm. I reach out my hand, speak to him softly, telling him he's all right, though he's anything but. From time to time, a nurse technician or orderly appears to check on him on his IV, heart monitor, oxygen flow, vital signs, anything but vital now. And one, sounding amazed, says, wow, still here. She means not me, but my father, hanging on another night after we were told he might only have hours more to go. When dawn arrives, he keeps on breathing, no change, or so it seems. My sister comes half whispering, we chat a bit. I go, step pensively into the morning light, meet my brother on the street. How is he? The same. And who knew life could be so strange? We often differ, but now, sad-eyed, he nods. Help me up, my father calls out, struggling to raise himself to a sitting position. The tangle of tubes and wires trembles as he moves, and I'm torn between helping him rise and convincing him to lie back. The third night, 3 a.m., dark night of the soul. The spirit's journey from its bodily home to a union with God, full of hardships, difficulties, detaching from this world. So St. John of the Cross described this time. The soul's goal, he would say, to reach, achieve the light of union with its creator. But what is mine? A skeptic at best who feels certain of nothing but that I don't want my father to suffer or to die. I slip my hand beneath his scrawny back to hold him up and feel his impulse fade. Guide him back to the pillow, murmuring reassurance, telling him there's no need to get up. He just needs to lie still, rest in the bed. But how do I know what he needs now? And rest for what? For death? So each time he tries to rise, I help him, then ease him back once again, over and over and over through the long night. Only days later, after he's gone, will it come to me. In his delirium, he thinks he is lying still on the floor with his broken collarbone, calling out for help to rise up, be made whole again. But right now, all I know is he needs me to help him, body and soul, through this night that, though neither of us may know it, will be his last. All I know is he wants my help. He's not yet ready to rest in peace. I'm sitting in my parents' living room with my mother and brother when the call comes through. My brother answers, listens, raises his gaze to me, and nods as our mother looks down at the carpet. My father's gone. This morning, my nephew relieved me at his bedside, and I said, he had a rough night, kept wanting to rise up in the bed, but he's hanging in there. How much longer, I wondered, could he last? My mother accepts the news quietly. My brother announces he's staying put. but I want to go to see him. Who knows why or why each of us reacts as we do. I drive myself to the hospital. It turns out the moment my father chose, if he did, was one when his two daughters sat by his bedside. A curious choice, it seems to me, since one of them had been for years on end now anything but kind. And though we're brought together by our loss, both sisters seem to understand I need to sit alone a while beside my father, or what remains of him, indulge my grief. For now at last, my turn has come to weep. Holding his cold hand as his nails turn blue, I recall the story he loved to tell about the time when I was born. My mother, recovering in the hospital, saw his yellow nails and thought he must be ill. Afraid to ask, she kept her fears quiet, and only when she got home did she find the cause. To surprise her, my father had painted the kitchen yellow. He was fine, and I and my mother healthy as well. My sisters reappear, and I force myself to let his hand go, cease weeping, except he's gone. But how can I leave him alone? It's he who's left me, though, for parts unknown. At least, I hope he's still out there, somewhere. His body now just an aged ruin lies stiffening, and my sister, the good one, tells me he took in one last shallow breath, but never exhaled. He went peacefully. So why do I feel unknotted, ruined, undone? Late last night, alone with him in the dark, I whispered more than once, "It's okay, Dad, for you to go now. I know you're in pain. I don't want you to suffer. It's all right to let it all end here. I'll miss you, but you don't need to linger, endure. Let go if you're ready." I wanted, I think, to be with him when he died. Did he not want that? Did he feel the need to spare me that last breath? One more thing about him I'll never know. I wish I could say it was going to get cheerier, but it'll be a little bit less intense. That was probably the most intense it's going to get. So I'm going to read just three more shorter poems, not that short, but shorter, which focus on my mother, who lived another 2 years and 2 months, but had a series of strokes and ended up losing the power of speech in the last few months of her life. So she had a very difficult passage as well. This poem is called The Reason for Living, and it begins with an epigraph from Faulkner. "The reason for living is to get ready to stay dead a long time." "If everything that happens, happens for a reason, there must be some reason my mother's still alive. This reason thing was her stab at wisdom, words she applied like a salve whenever misfortune struck. Now 8 months past the stroke that left her speechless, she lies in the bed and laughs at my silly jokes while my niece laps along at the other side of the bed. I brought this niece 3,000 miles to see my mother one last time, to say goodbye. But not explicitly, of course, since no one's talking yet about the end, which may be far off still, or not. Talk as we may, of death we say nothing at all. But at some point, alone with my mother again, as I had been so many times before, after my siblings had fled and before I did, privy to so much my mother needed to tell someone, I seize the moment, or perhaps stumble toward it, and find myself saying, well, we all have to die. Even now, I can't figure out how or why I thought, even for an instant, I ought to say that. But I'll always remember the look she gave me then, a strange mixture of outrage and deep distress. It told me wordlessly what a mistake it had been to presume to speak about our common fate to her when death was for me, or seemed anyway to be, far off, while hers seemed nearer each minute, each day. I'm sorry, and I told her I shouldn't have said that. Her face softened then, and she seemed to forgive me. But I'll take that look with me to my own deathbed. And what I've thought since is she never was ready to die at all. Never mind, stay dead a long time. Nor will I be, I suspect, when my time has come. So this is the poem which actually is about my mother's death. It's very different from the other poem about my father's death. And shorter. Opening the window. Does it matter if we're matter merely, or body and soul, divisible, whole, united for a time before the soul departs the body's jail? A bold escape, since there's no certainty beyond the skin, a liberation into empty air? Perhaps there's much more to it than all that. But how much more? Or if there's nothing more, no soul at all, the body on its own, and when that's done, endless oblivion, what's there to care about except what is? No more or less to do than simply live? Here at my brother's place, I'm half asleep, drifting through reckless when the call arrives, a wake-up call, and now the nightmare starts. Come, quick, my brother says, Mom's going fast, don't hesitate, or you might be too late. 5 minutes later, I'd have hit the shower, missed the call. I don yesterday's clothes, drive to the nursing home fast as I can, and find my siblings and my brother's son around her bed. She's waited, it would seem, unlike my father, for us all to meet beside her bed to bid a last farewell. The others move away to let me get close to her mother, take her hand in mine. Then a nurse comes, and as if there could be something important left for her to do, displaces me and checks the fading pulse and tells us all our mother's gone at last. She lets the dead hand drop and makes her way to the window, opens it, turns back, says, I'm letting her soul go, then disappears, leaving the rest of us to stare across the still warm body at each other, down at Mom, not quite believing what we know. Silence, then murmured words, a last touch, kiss, bending over what moments before was our mother. And that nurse comes back to say the undertakers have been called. Too quick, I think. They want the goddamn bed. The others, though, seem ready to depart. I need more time, I say. I'll wait till they come by for her. It's silly, maybe, but I don't want for her to be alone just yet. The others go. I promise to follow, then turn back to the bed. It doesn't help. She's gone already, too. I'm on my own. When the funeral guys arrive, they're shocked to find me waiting by the cooling corpse of my dead mother. I just didn't want, I explained, to leave her alone. Okay, the kinder of the two replies, but now you might want to go. You can stay, he explains, but then you'll have to watch us put her inside this bag. It's a black thing, like a sleeping bag, but shiny, rolled up on the gurney behind him. It's something you'll remember, he adds, for your whole life. We'll take good care of her. And so I go. As I move down the hall and out the door, my thoughts remain behind. In my mind's eye, I see two bored young men lift up the corpse half absentmindedly and stuff it in the gleaming bag, their minds on mundane things. How long till lunch? Who might they nail tonight? Back in the car, I sit a moment, then it strikes me I don't even want to see them rolling out the body to the hearse. I flee this parking lot, this nursing home I'll never see again. Drive past a house no longer ours, and realize all I've lost. So you might be relieved to know that this is the last poem. Called More Bitter Blues, which is a kind of pun on the Spike Lee More Better Blues, which some of you might remember. But it also has an Irish proverb at the start, Bitter the tears that fall, but more bitter the tears that fall not. I couldn't stop crying when my father died. Now that my mother's gone, I can't seem to start. When she died, a nurse lifted the window sash to let her soul out. She fled, it seemed, without delay, scorning the worn-out body that held or held back her soul more than 89 years. In former times, the people I come from placed lighted candles around the corpse, draped with cloth all mirrors in the dead one's room, stopped all clocks as if to illustrate the end of time. Instead, we passed her body off to strangers who did things to it we don't want to know. The church my parents attended for 50 years is closed for repairs, so the funeral mass takes place in the neighboring town in a church none of us have ever before been inside. I give the eulogy from a lofty perch, and the priest, a cousin, speaks consoling words. Outside, afterwards, a neighbor whose father died only months before tells a funny tale. A man, it seems, who broke into the line of cars headed for the church got pulled over by the cops. His father, once a captain in the state police, would have loved to witness that. As we bury my mother in the one same grave where my father and his parents lie, I ask myself whether or not she might have preferred to be with her own people, as the saying goes. Did she see herself as belonging to her husband's close-knit family? I suspect not. Then I think of my ex-wife, remarried now, with whom I thought I'd spend the rest of my life. Will I even hear about it when she dies? Or she about me if my time should come first? My parents are together now forever, my ex-wife and I eternally apart. After the funeral, we gathered at some local restaurant and fed all the mourners. We talked of things and people and times past, the present and future my parents will never see. Now the bad sister's here in our brother's home. Will I see her again? Not if I can help it, I think, though I know hearing me say as much would make our parents terribly sad. But they're gone now, and soon I will be too, back to a life where she has no place. From some we never quite part, while others die for us before their bodies do. The night after our mother died, my sister, the good one, had a visit from her spirit. Not restless, exactly, but not quite prepared to leave behind the comforts of this world. Are you cold? My sister asked. Would you like to come under the covers with me for a while? Silently, the spirit slipped between the sheets, and my sister held what seemed to be her body, trying to warm her, perhaps, for the journey that lay ahead. I have to go, she blurted, and rose suddenly from the bed. Okay, Mom, my sister replied, and watched her spirit fade. Were you scared? Someone asked after she told that story the next day. Not at all, she said. It was comforting. And I thought, why didn't our mother come to me as well, or instead? My sister swore it was real, not just some dream she'd had. Who'd care, I thought, if only she'd come. There's an end to everything, including ends. And what doesn't end endures, and life resumes. And in a way, even what's over persists. Eventually, though, everyone goes home, if they can, to whatever life they have left. Time, then, to pack my things and disappear. Thanks for listening.